And now you're going to be listening to So Far and Yet So Near on 103.5 FM 209 Radio. Welcome to our final show of the week. I am Hannah Higginson.
And I am Derek Thorne. And with today's theme of diversity, we have a real range of features and opinions for you to listen to, including...
some Indian classical music. We find out how it differs from music of the West, and you'll be hearing some of it too.
Coverage of a diversity day at Bassingbourne Village College, where a group of volunteers went along to the school and shared their experiences and native culture.
And we'll be playing live on air a new board game called War on Terror. If you have any questions for the makers of the game or want to comment on anything else about the programme, then you can text us on 07968 898254.
But let's start with Make Poverty History. You may well remember this huge campaign that took place last year, in which numerous organisations came together and demanded justice for the world's poor. Specifically, the campaign had three demands for the government and international decision makers: fairer international trade rules, more and better aid, and to cancel the debt of the world's poorest countries. Now, although Make Poverty History had a very high profile last summer, people are wondering now whether it worked.
So last night, the Cambridge Division of the World Development Movement, which is an organisation campaigning for global justice, held an event in which we asked the question, in which rather they asked the question, where next? First to speak was Vicky Can, Policy Officer for the World Development Movement, and she began by telling us where Make Poverty History fell short.
One of the main problems that we saw with the campaign was that while in many ways it did manage to reach out to a huge number of people in the UK, on the other hand, we were only able to do that because Make Poverty History had such a very general call. It was a very general call for global justice, which, to be honest, very few people can disagree with. And what that meant was that really we were able to be, I think, co-opted by the UK government. So we saw Tony Blair wearing the white armband, almost, I think, taking credit for the campaign around Make Poverty History. And so really, I think we let the UK government off the hook, because in many ways, the UK government is a real problem in terms of solving global poverty issues. And while collectively the leaders of the richest nations at the G8 made a few very small steps towards boosting overall aid levels and trying to tackle debt relief, in many ways those issues are still just as big as they were before. And in particular, the critical issue of trade and trade justice wasn't tackled at all by rich countries during the year of 2005. So the rhetoric that politicians were using about Make Poverty History in actual fact was really quite empty.
So what would you say are the key things that the British government and other governments need to do to really tackle these issues? You mentioned trade justice. Can you talk us through and drop the debt? Can you talk us through those issues a bit more and what they need to commit to?
Well, on debt, I think many people think that the issue of developing countries' debt has been solved in the past, but that is not the case. And continually we're told that, yes, these countries' debts are finally being eradicated, but it's not. There are 60 countries, at least 60 countries around the world that need full debt cancellation, and those 60 countries are not yet having their overall debts cancelled. There are a number of countries that still require debt cancellation. So that's one issue. But the other critical issue, I think, is trade justice. And at the World Trade Organization talks in Hong Kong, where the talks were hyped up as being about development and about developing countries, there was no progress for developing countries. There were some minor changes on the issue of agriculture, which were put forward by rich countries, the EU and the US, as being a great step forward for poor countries. But in actual fact, they were very, very minor wins for poor countries. And instead, there was a massively aggressive agenda by the EU and by the US to push forward trade negotiations where, to be honest, developing countries are in a weak position to negotiate. So I think on trade justice, there was a real lack of progress last year, and that was very, very disappointing.
What are the World Development Movement doing to campaign on these issues? What is your agenda?
Well, we're a democratic membership organisation. We have groups like the group in Cambridge all around the country, and we are particularly focused on three issues. We are continuing to work on the issue of trade justice, and we're continuing to monitor the ongoing negotiations that are happening, not just at big meetings like in Hong Kong, but behind the scenes in Geneva as well. We have a big campaign around getting better quality aid from the UK government, particularly with regards to how they spend aid money on pushing water privatisation in developing countries, even though the evidence shows that water privatisation doesn't deliver for the world's poorest people. And we continue to press for full debt cancellation without conditions attached for the 60-plus poor countries that really need it around the world.
That was Vicky Can from the World Development Movement speaking there. And you can find out more about the WDM at wdm.org.uk or the Cambridge one at cambridgewdm.org.uk.
Also speaking at the meeting was Kofi Mawuli-Klu, who is the chair of the Pan-African Task Force for Internationalist Dialogue and who is originally from Ghana. He told us that Make Poverty History campaign was run without sufficient voices from African people or indeed others in the developing world, and that this was disappointing given the UK's background in campaigning.
We applaud the efforts of all those who came together in the campaign to eradicate poverty, because we think it's one of the biggest scourges facing African people and all, you know, and humanity worldwide. It's quite a shame that in this day and age, humanity, you know, which has all the means to eradicate poverty now, still hasn't been able to do so because of the lack of political will. And we see that as a task that has to be accomplished. But we also recognize that the way and manner in which the Make Poverty History campaign was put together and the way and manner it tried to work on these issues were bound to bring about the kind of failures that it has brought about. And we are trying to remind people that we expected better of people in Britain who have a very, very rich experience of campaigning on global justice issues, particularly as relates to African people. And we point to the fact that it is people in Britain who rose to support the campaign to end chattel enslavement of African people, the bicentenary of the Palermo abolition, which is in 2007. You know, it's the same British people who rose in support of the anti-colonial movement and put an end to the so-called British Empire that's actually, you know, terrorized millions of people around the globe. And again, as part of that also, the great British public's involvement in the anti-apartheid campaign against even the grain of what the British government, you know, wanted. And we think that against that background, to show such total disregard for the campaigning experience of Britain and do such shoddy work of Make Poverty History, you know, it's just surprising. But we believe that those who genuinely are committed to the eradication of poverty, who know what is really on the ground in those parts of the world where people are suffering from abject poverty, will be able to use the lessons from the Make Poverty History campaign to take the struggle forward. And we believe that with the lessons that we can now all learn from the Make Poverty History campaign, against the background of what there is to learn from the campaigning history in Britain, we really can move forward towards the complete eradication of poverty in our time.
That was Kofi Mawuli-Klu, and you can get more on the Pan-African Task Force for Internationalist Dialogue at www.uhuruutando, which is spelled U-H-U-R-U-U-T-A-N-D-O.org.
We also obtained another view on this issue of development last week as part of One World Week. Cambridge University International Development organised a talk with Dr. Moyo, who is currently managing partner of Actis and who also served as Zimbabwe's Minister for Industry and Trade. He spoke about Africa's challenges for development, an important one being to bring the voice of Africans into the process.
I think the main one is the quality of the interface between what I call development partners and the recipient countries. The quality of that relationship and how the interface is working is probably actually degrading the attainment of sustainable development rather than enhancing it. There should be better understanding of how to use resources. Should be a better identification and involvement of the recipients in the identification of what the issues are, so that when the resources are made available, they are properly applied.
So in the talk that you just gave, you gave a wonderful story that illustrated this point about your mother. I was wondering if you could recount that for us.
in sort of parentheses, if you like, I will paraphrase it in the sense that I bought a property for my mother, and my mother proceeded to live in that property in a way where I was tempted almost to sort of tell her how to live in the house because I had bought it. But I held back and respected the fact that I had bought the property as my mother's house as opposed to as an investment. And as a result, my mother got to be comfortable, felt it was her home. She got comfortable, managed it very efficiently as it happens, her own way. But I gave her the space to feel that it was her house, her home, if you like. And I supported her as opposed to overwhelming and being overbearing on her. Supported as she moved and adjusted to an environment which otherwise was quite foreign to her.
So do you think that Western donors at the moment, what do you think their role should be within Africa and in within giving aid?
Respectful support. I mean, I can only think of it in terms of I do things differently, I ought to accept the legitimacy of the other party as being different from mine, as opposed to imposing my own world as the only legitimate world. And I think that's where the crux of the problem tends to be.
That's Dr. Nkosana Moyo speaking there. You're listening to So Far and Yet So Near on 209 Radio, 103.5 FM.
On any given week, you can expect to hear a massive diversity of music being performed around Cambridge. This is good news for Derek and I because there's no shortage of musical styles for us to learn about and record for your listening pleasure.
And most recently, we've been treated to some Indian classical music, courtesy of Cambridge University's Hindu Cultural Society, who held an event called Sangeet Sandhya. There was a real breadth of instruments used on the night, all the way from traditional drums to an electric guitar, and we'll be hearing some of the music in a moment. But firstly, how is Indian classical music different to Western music? What is special about it? Well, two of the performers were nice enough to explain everything for me, Alpa Shah and firstly, Dilesh Harrier.
A lot of you would be familiar with Western music, such as like Beethoven, Mozart, that sort of classical music, where it's very all written down on paper and then you play what you read. Whereas Indian classical music, I guess, is a lot more sort of freedom, there's a lot more variance. It's a lot more about how you can express yourself and improvisation.
And you're also talking about kind of the tones, the chord tones. So I suppose when we look at a piano between two keys, there's a particular gap in the tone. So what's the differences there?
Basically, if you look at a piano and you go up the scale from like C to another C, you'd go up in semitones, which is what we're used to in the Western music. But if you go into Indian classical music, there's like certain notes in between the actual semitones, which is known as quarter tones. So there's a lot more range of music, a lot more range of notes that you can actually use.
What effect do you find that kind of music has on an ear that hasn't really heard it before? I mean, do people hear it and they go, oh, that's out of tune, or what?
I guess I wouldn't expect that to be a reaction, but I'd expect most people, because it actually would sound quite nice. It goes with how it's, if you look at the whole maths behind it, it does flow naturally in the scale of the hertz, so it does sound quite natural. So it's nothing out of the ordinary, and people usually like the sort of music they hear.
Okay, so moving on to you, Alpa, could you tell me then what you were doing tonight?
Okay, well, I was singing a North Indian classical piece, first of all. And in North Indian classical music, basically, you have different scales. They're like different melodic structures, and they're called rags. And each rag is based on a particular scale, a combination of 5 to 7 notes from the scale. And then you use those notes in improvisation. There's a song, a main song, and then you improvise around it. So you improvise slowly, first of all, and then you improvise in a more faster rhythm. And then after that, I sang a song called Atharana, which is a song of meaningless words. It's just a really fast song to a fast rhythm, and it's to bring out the beauty in the rag.
Now, also, next to you on the stage, something that fascinated me was this kind of white box, which was producing like a drone, I suppose. So what was that?
That box was simulating the sound of an instrument called the tanpura. And that instrument, it looks a bit like a sitar, which you also saw, which is a long instrument with... and this instrument has 4 strings, and they're to provide the drone in the background, to provide the pitch for the singer so that they stay in tune.
Okay, and these things were obviously on the stage a couple of times, and also there was the guitar. So does this kind of represent, you know, a modernisation perhaps of the music, or what?
In terms of the white box, I think that's more for convenience purposes. It's quite hard to bring a big tanpura into to university. The guitar definitely is symbolises sort of the westernisation fusion thing that's up and coming right now.
Okay, and is this, I mean, a good thing? Is this regarded as something that's, you know, progressive and cool?
I'd say it's a good thing from my point of view, as in it's sort of like, I guess, just progressing the music. A lot more these days, obviously, you're starting to hear the sort of mainstream line down the pop charts and stuff. It's sort of Desi Beats, Bhangra Beats, Punjabi MC, I'm sure you heard. They all use a sort of classical, traditional folk music from India. So as you can see, it's becoming more and more popular. A lot of the fusion stuff is definitely picking up. People like Zakir Hussain, Dalvin Singh, they're just a couple of rhythmists that have definitely picked up on the fusion.
Okay, so finally, could you guys plug some events for us then? So tell us what's coming up that you guys are organising that people can go to.
Our biggest show is Mastana. It's on the 12th of March, and it's being held in Cambridge Arts Theatre. It's one of the biggest cultural shows in East Anglia. Draws a huge crowd, and it will have a range of stuff from dances to comedy to music.
And the money goes to?
And the money does go to charity. This is why it's one of the biggest events, because all the money goes to charity. We don't keep any for ourselves.
That was Dilesh Harrier and Alpa Shah talking to us after their Sangeet Sandhya musical event. And if you want to learn more about Cambridge University Hindus Cultural Society and their events and activities, you can go to www.cuhcs.org.uk.
But we can't let you hear all about Indian classical music without playing you some. So here is a piece performed on that night by Alpa and Dilesh. It's called Rag Malkounds, and it's in the Tiental or 16-beat cycle. Sound of Alpa Shah and Dilesh Harrier. This is So Far and Yet So Near on 209 Radio 103.5 FM. Thank you very much for joining us this evening. Now then, the theme for today on the station is diversity. So now let's hear about a project which is allowing children in the Cambridge area to learn more about the cultural diversity that surrounds them. A couple of weeks ago, Bassingbourne Village College held a day for its Year 7s, titled Appreciating Diversity and Difference, in which a number of people from different parts of the world came into the school and ran classes all about their respective countries. These people were all volunteers with Harambee, Cambridge's global education centre, and one of those was Stephanie Bengtson, who has spent 16 years of her life in Zimbabwe. Just after her class, we spoke with her about what activities she'd just been doing with the children.
I started with some sort of basic geography aspects, the fact that Zimbabwe is shaped like a teapot, which is very exciting. And then I was sort of looking at a bit of an exploration of the diverse cultures in Zimbabwe through music. So looking at the South African influence, the British influence, and then, of course, the Shona and the Ndebele, who were indigenous to the area.
And you had quite a good metaphor for the geography of Zimbabwe. So tell me about that.
Okay, so the teapot shape of Zimbabwe, it is actually, if you look at the map, it is shaped like a teapot. And what's particularly cool about it is that where the spout is actually the location of the Victoria Falls, which are this sort of massive waterfalls, in Zimbabwe.
Okay, and then you were talking about the different kind of cultures that go to make it up. So how did you kind of incorporate that in that metaphor?
Well, I started up with talking about how you would make a pot of tea and how you could make it stronger and change the flavours. And so I introduced various tea bags. We had the Shona tea bag, the Ndebele tea bag, and the British and the South African ones.
It all meant then that there was kind of an interactive and accessible way, I suppose, to get to grips with what was going on in Zimbabwe.
Exactly. I think when you're talking to 11 and 12-year-olds, it's important to give them these images that will stick in their minds, something simple, but that helps them remember things.
That leads me on to the kind of things, you know, you would like to be sticking in their minds. I mean, what kind of impressions do you feel they might have, and what kind of new impressions would you like to give them?
Well, I think very often when people think about Africa, if they think about Africa, they tend to think poverty, they tend to think starvation. And I think it's important to remember that we're dealing with different people who all have very, very interesting cultures, and we can learn a lot from these cultures. And so I think just messages like, I think my session ended up being a little bit politically minded. I was explaining in sort of simple terms how colonialism happened and sort of these issues of race, which are quite sensitive, and basically how everything worked together to produce what we have as Zimbabwe today.
I suppose you didn't really want to shy away then, did you, from those big issues? Because you did also mention, you know, Mugabe and, was it Operation Clean Up Rubbish?
Yes, exactly. Well, I think it's very, very important. And I think if you can get 11, 12-year-olds interested in a country, then you can get them interested in the politics. And I think these are important issues because they help us into a sort of bigger global understanding. And maybe, you know, one day we will go and help in a country without just thinking charity work, without just trying to feed people, and actually sort of work together with them to get a stronger global community.
That's Stephanie Benston, who is a Global Voices volunteer with the Harambee Centre in Cambridge. You can find out more of that about them by going to all the W's at harambeecentre, all one word, lowercase, .org.uk, or to their offices on the Emmanuel United Reformed Church on Trumpington Street.
Now then, you might be wondering what these classes actually sounded like. Well, in the class about South Africa, Nomfundo, Zinia and Gwenya taught about 30 Year 7s how to ululate. Now, this is a vocal tradition in South Africa and elsewhere that involves... Well, I think perhaps I'm not the man to explain it, and I don't think Hannah's willing to give a demonstration either. So, we're going to hear Zinia pitting the boys in the class against the girls and firstly doing it herself, and then the girls will do it, and then the boys, and then finally the girls will finally try to win and beat the boys. So anyway, here we go. Let's listen to the class.
I started with some sort of basic geography aspects, the fact that Zimbabwe...
Okay, the girls, I'll lead you, and then you join in, okay? Then you do it. No, you use your tongue, you get your tongue... Okay, let's see if the guys can do it. Are the boys going to ululate for us? Why is it that the boys always do better than the girls? Oh, the girls want to have another go. Okay, I'll join you. Let's go. 1, 2, 3.
So there you go, that's Nomfundo, Zinia and Gwenya doing a very large amount of ululating with the Year 7 class there. And so, you might be wondering now, what did the kids think? I spoke to two of the Year 7 pupils, who are called Bram and Amelia, about their favourite parts of the day. And Amelia began by telling me about this very session on South Africa.
We learnt what counties were in South Africa, and we had to do this game where we learnt which ones were in South Africa and which ones weren't, and we learnt what languages they spoke there in the main language, which is Zulu, and we learnt all the like sounds in most of the words in Zulu language.
And I think you were also doing some singing or making sounds. What was that?
Well, they all make like little sounds, like with a GH, like, and in most of their words there's these sounds.
Okay, and Bram, you also went to South Africa today. So what was your favourite part of the South Africa session that you went to?
Probably when she taught us how to do the ululating thing, which the women do when they're happy.
Yeah, ululating. So what I want to know is, can you give us a demonstration? I mean, did you guys learn how to do it?
I can't do it.
Oh, right. And Amelia, no?
I might be able to, but I'm not very good at it.
Give it a go. Go on. That is brilliant, I think. What do you say?
Yeah, it's really good.
Excellent. There you go. So you've definitely learned how to do something today. But, I mean, why do you think this is a good thing? I mean, why do you think it's a good idea for you guys to be hearing about countries like South Africa and the others that you've been hearing about? Bram, what do you think?
Well, so when we if we go to those places, then we know a little bit about them, so we can, that will just help us when we get there.
Okay, and what about you, Amelia? I mean, for example, I'm sure there are lots of people from South Africa in Britain, people from Pakistan. That's another country you've been hearing about. So, you know, do you think it's good that you kind of know more about those countries now if those people are living here?
Well, I think it's much better because if we, like, say, go to there and we find what they do extremely weird and disturbing, then we know already what they do, and not to find it weird and disturbing, just to find it normal for what they feel.
That was Bram and Amelia from Bassingbourne Village College telling me all about the Diversity Day, which they just experienced courtesy of the Harambee Centre's Global Voices volunteers.
So we've reached that exciting point in the show where we are going to do a first for So Far and Yet So Near and play a board game on air.
And this is not just any board game, it's made in Cambridge and it's called War on Terror. And with us to explain everything is a man known generally and locally as Andy T. And I wonder whether he could tell us, I don't know what the T stands for. What does the T stand for?
Tompkins.
Andy Tompkins, thank you very much. I can't believe I didn't research that very important point. All right, so anyway, we've got this set up right in front of us. Andy, please tell us, what made you want to make a board game all about, or called War on Terror?
Well, the official title was War on Terror, the board game.
Oh, sorry. Okay. I apologise.
So yeah. I made it with, it's a partnership between me and a very good friend called Andrew Sheeran. And in 2003, just before we invaded Iraq, me and Andrew were watching Newsnight, drunk, and at the end of the night, we had the idea of making a board game called The War on Terror.
Okay, and is it now, I mean, is it now a reality? We've got it obviously in front of us, but are there any more copies of it around?
This is the only copy at the moment. We're currently working on some advanced prototypes. But it is reality, and we've now got the investment to actually get 5,000 of these made.
Whoa, okay, right. Well, I'm just going to explain what it looks like, because we do have it set out in the studio in front of us. So the board, basically, is wonderfully... It is actually drawn, isn't it? This is an original drawn...
It looks incredible.
Yeah, this is
handmade, definitely.
Okay, so it is basically a map of the world, but it's kind of simplified, so there's maybe... I don't know, only 30 countries on it as opposed to how many hundred there really are. It's about 3 feet by 2 feet. There's quite a few pieces on there because we've kind of already set it up so that it's as if we're kind of, you know, partway into a game and we're going to be playing it in a moment. And yeah, I mean, tell us more. I mean, basically, the board, do you move around this board essentially? What do you do?
Well, you start the game as an empire and you start with just two villages. And during the course of the start of the game, you expand your empire by developing, so you can develop more villages, towns and cities. And whilst you do that, you discover oil in these various countries. So some countries have a higher chance of getting oil than others.
Okay, and
And we've got some cards over here. We've got terrorist cards and empire cards. Can you tell us a bit about them?
Well, in the game, if you're an empire, you play with empire cards. If you get knocked out as an empire, all your developments get destroyed, or you're bankrupt, you become a terrorist player and you play with terrorist cards. But if you're... Well, there's also the Axis of Evil spinner on the board, if you see it just here.
I can't see it.
Yeah, this is like the Game of Life spinner, but slightly different.
Axis of Evil plastered across it.
Yeah, yeah. So what does that mean?
Well, every now and again, if you roll a certain symbol on the dice, or there's a card where you can play it, and you get to spin the Axis of Evil, if that points towards your colour, you become an evil empire, and you get to play with both terrorist and empire cards.
Okay, that's interesting. Should we play?
Let's play.
Okay, right.
Take
some cards.
I'm well hyped about this. Okay, so we're pretending that we're partway into a game.
We've all been given a pile of cards. I think I've got six cards in my hand.
Yeah. I wonder if we could. Yeah.
Two red ones and four black ones. Is that normal?
Well, you kind of in the game. I mean, the red ones are terrorist cards. So you generally, when you're evil, you pick up a few terrorist cards. You can steal them off other players. So. Yeah, I thought we'd have a mix of both terrorists and empire.
Okay, so I've actually got three red to two black cards. Yeah. Does that mean I'm actually a bit more like a terrorist in this game?
Well, it depends what you play. I mean, you don't have to play these terrorist cards if you don't want to. I mean, you can get through the game without funding any terrorism at all.
Okay.
If you really want to.
Right, and on the other end, can you also go for terrorism?
Yeah, we did have one player, Andrew Sheeran's brother actually, who decided to quit being an empire in his very first turn and turned terrorist. From his first turn.
No messing around.
And the other end of the scale, we had someone who refused to fund terrorism and moral issues.
Okay. That. Right. So. I mean, does either of these have a better outcome, generally?
It's hard to say.
I
don't know. Not funding terrorism is difficult because, you know, as an empire, you know, it kind of helps to fund a bit of terrorism. But if you fund too much, you've got to be careful because obviously if you knock someone out, that they can then control the terrorists. So,
do you think that's a genuine reflection on the world today? How much does this game reflect?
Well, it is a satire. Well, I mean, the idea of it, obviously, you know, you've got Al-Qaeda, and that was originally funded by, obviously, CIA. So, I mean, there's issues there, and there's kind of satire involved.
Right, let's stay away from libel and play the game. So, all right, so whose turn is it? Who wants to go?
Do you want to go first?
Yeah.
So you get to roll the action dice.
Okay. Right, okay.
It's a big white dice.
Okay, so you
get
an extra card and two developments. That means.
So does that, I choose either, do I? Either an Empire
Well,
Empire
you're not
or...
evil at the moment, so you can only play with, you can only collect Empire cards.
I'm down with that. Okay, so an Empire card.
You get two free anyway.
Oh, right, okay. So every go.
Yeah, every go.
Okay, so I've got here war. Preempt the preemption, it's war baby and we don't do body counts. So here we go. Attack empires or terrorists in bordering countries or terrorists within your empire can be used in defence against other war cards. So what does this mean? I can wage war on someone?
Yeah, so I mean the war is quite a common card, both the war and terrorist attack cards, so you know there's a good majority of them in the pack. So that means that you can attack any bordering country. So we're saying you're green. Say in Ukraine, you could attack Western Russia.
Okay, so if I'm green, I'm currently in Europe, basically. So I'm kind of in Western Europe, Scandinavia,
and
yeah.
How does Derek go about attacking Western Russia? Does he then roll again, or...?
Well, if he decides to attack, he plays the war card, and he says, okay, I'm going to attack Western Russia. And if we say I'm blue... I haven't got any war cards, so I can't defend.
Okay.
So then you just roll the dice, and if you hit the red numbers on the card, that means it's destroyed. You've blown my city up.
Wow. Yeah. So can we do it? Can I attack
you?
Yeah,
go for it.
Cool.
I remember
this it. It's another of 209 Radio First, War on Air.
Okay, here we go. And it's four. Unfortunately...
It's not high enough actually to attack his country.
So whenever you play a card, it goes to the bottom of the pack.
Oh. So what actually happened in reality? I mean, did I, you know, get fought off by you? Somehow, or...
You missed.
I missed.
Yeah, you probably ended up in the sea or something like that.
Fired and missed. Great.
I mean, you can, with the war as well, you have to be careful because you can blow yourself up. Yeah. Collateral damage on there as well.
Okay. The idea of missing a country as large as Russia...
Well, you missed my city.
It doesn't reflect too well on me. But anyway, all right. So let's Hannah,
okay, let me roll. So
To finish your go, you have to roll the oil dice. So you just roll two dice.
Two dice, okay.
So these are the oil dice.
Yeah, so basically this is where all the money comes from in the game. You have to kind of secure the best oil. So you've rolled a six. So anyone who's got a development on a six, which is me by the looks of things, I get loads of money. I get 300 million from my city and my town.
Wow, that's quite a lot.
That's a lot of money.
And we've actually got a pile of money here as well, kind of like, where's this from? You've printed it, haven't you?
Yeah, that's actually stolen from a kind of colonial African banknote. So
okay.
That won't be in the final game. The final game's being illustrated by a good friend of ours.
Cool. Okay, right, Hannah, go for it.
Okay, so I'm going to roll this big white dice.
Yeah.
There it goes.
So you've got three developments, no extra special things on that, I'm afraid.
Oh,
so you pick up two cards, you have two free cards.
Two Empire cards.
Yeah.
So...
Ooh, two terrorist attacks.
Okay, so I've got in front of me terrorist attack cards.
Mm-hmm.
It says, unpredictable, like a bus. They can strike at any time, anywhere. And I'm actually instructed to incite a terrorist unit to attack the development in that country or to attack themselves. Terrorist infighting. Yeah. So what does this mean in board game terms?
Okay, so in board game terms, if you see on the board, we've got these coloured counters, which are the different empires. We've got green, blue and yellow here. But all the black counters are the terrorists. So these are terrorist cells, terrorist columns and terrorist...
And these are kind of spread around, aren't they?
Yeah, they're all over the board.
So you can buy terrorists in your turn. So if we were playing the game, you'd have money and we could be buying terrorists and laying them anywhere on the board. So, for example, with that one, if you wanted to try and, you know, you've got a terrorist column in Siberia and I've got a town in Siberia, you played a terrorist attack card, much like the war, and you say, okay...
Okay, so should I do that now?
Yeah, let's
see. I'm laying my terrorist attack card down.
Survive another attack.
And I'm going to throw the dice again.
Yep. So you're attacking a town.
Okay.
So you want a 6 to a 10, really.
So can you hear it? And...
Oh, there we go.
I got 10.
Siberia's dead.
Siberia's dead.
My town is gone, yeah.
Okay, so the terrorists are now roaming around Siberia,
so,
aren't they?
So, yeah, the terrorists are still in there. That means you could develop in Siberia now.
Okay, so I now own Siberia.
Yeah, well, no, not yet. You'd have to develop in there. But
We'll have to cut it a bit short there, because we are running a bit short. But I did want to ask you, Andy, and if people want to know more about this, what can they do? Where can they go?
Well, they can go to warontherrortheboardgame.com.
Okay.
Yeah.
And, I mean, are these going to be in shops or what?
Yes, I mean, we're talking to distributors at the moment, both in America and Australia. We've yet to tie up England.
Okay, and they're being made in large numbers, are they?
Batches of 5,000 to start
with. Okay, and whereabouts is that?
At the moment, we're talking to an American manufacturer, but actually they would be made in China.
Okay.
Which is
quite
interesting.
Other issues there.
Yes.
Anyway, okay.
So that's the end of So Far and Yet So Near for tonight. And that's our last show of the week. So thanks for listening. And don't forget to check 209's radio archive in case you've missed anything. Just go to 209radio.co.uk.
And thanks for listening very much. And to end, here's a bit more Indian classical music to play us out. It's from the Cambridge University Hindu Cultural Society, who you heard earlier. This piece features a guitar and a mridangam drum. So there you go. Have a nice evening. Thanks to Andy T for coming in. Goodbye.